Hello, welcome to Poet Runner. Today we have Patricia Selena Suarez, and I also have my co-host, Ricky Modiano, and we'll be talking to her about her books and her poetry.
Okay, well, that's Priscilla Raphael.
Oh, crap. Oh, crap. Wait a minute. No, I thought it was Patricia. She said Patricia.
Well,
it's Patricia, right?
Anyway, we have Priscilla Selena Suarez, and you know, to sort of kick things off. Well, first of all, congratulations on La La Landia, your new book, another singular publication from Flower Song Press. They've been doing great work, and we've had several of their authors on the show. But so, tell us a little bit about how this book came together. It has a great versatility. That was one of the first things that I noticed, being bilingual, and there's a range of subjects. But, you know, how did you bring this book together?
Well, this book is a collection of poetry from the last maybe 10 years or so. And a lot of what inspires me is, of course, the regional culture, and that includes food, that includes music. And when they talk about music, there's a lot of different styles of music that I listen to. That comes from being someone who comes from a multicultural background, someone that was raised in the frontera, someone that's American. We have, you know, we as Americans, we listen to so many different genres of music. And so that has a lot to do with what inspired me. And there's just the diversity and everything that's been happening, the climate, the political climate in the Valley for the past 20 years. You know, it's so much has changed in the Valley. And so my poetry kind of goes all over the place, reminiscing to what it was like growing up where La Frontera, Reynosa, which is the sister city to McAllen, where I'm from, up to where we were sister cities, where, you know, we were connected, and into how now the younger generations, my nieces and nephews, how they see Reynosa as part of a whole different country. And to me, it just blows my mind that they haven't gone to Reynosa. It's just, you know, a 15-20 minute drive from McAllen, and for them, it's a whole different world that they haven't experienced. This book has a lot to do with reminiscing what it was like.
Well, I was going to say, it's a valuable resource because it has memory. It has the retrieval of memory, and it's all very vividly. I mean, you put it down very vividly, very specifically, and you know, that's of tremendous value because people who enter into this. I'm here in California. I have very little experience on the frontera. My father, during the Depression, hitchhiked through Texas looking for work. And he went to Galveston, where he thought they were going to be hiring dock workers, but they weren't. And he instead was arrested for vagrancy, thrown in jail. And most of the people that he was in there with were Spanish speakers, but that wasn't a problem for him because the language that he grew up with was Ladino, which is Judeo-Spanish, and it was very easy to switch to standard Spanish and talk to his fellow inmates, who he got along with wonderfully because of that. But he came back with a very bad impression of Texas law enforcement, and affected him, and of course he passed that on to me and my brother and my family, and like, Texas is bad, and also part of our family immigrated to Mexico. So when my immediate grandparents said, when they left the old country, they said, well, some of us are going to go to Mexico, some of us are going to go to the U.S., and we'll see which one works out. Well, the half of the family that went to Mexico stayed in Mexico. It worked out fine for them, and my half stayed here in the U.S. worked out fine for them. But there was a lot of back and forth, and I have tengo 25 familias mexicanas now, so that's a lot of people down there. One of the things that I really liked about the book was that there are poems in English, poems in Spanish, and I think that knowledge of a second language really is, you know, you have to me, I mean, I don't want to sound like an elitist, but I think that knowledge of a second language is always good because it throws your first tongue, the language that you were born growing up and speaking, you get an insight into it from knowing a second language. And people who are bilingual have what was technically called in linguistics the ability to code switch. They can go back and forth from one language to another. And when I read a poet that is bilingual like yourself, I can see immediately how they have a particular insight into both languages, that one language illuminates the other. They both, you know, they both become more vivid because of that. So I wanted to say that that was one of the things that really attracted me to your book. And since this represents 10 years of work, you've been writing like this, what, from the beginning? Did you start out switching back and forth between Spanish or English?
Actually, my first language was Spanish. I was a Spanish speaker. I grew up in Las Milpas, which is a colonia here in the valley, not too far from McAllen. And my family, we ended up moving into McAllen. And what we did, it was a whole different community, you know, just 10 minutes away, an entirely different community when it came to school. I was forced to learn to speak English, and now I'm an English speaker. That's my primary language, but I still think in Spanish. And here in the Valley, we code switch a lot. It's, you know, my Spanish is really bad. My English is really bad. I understand both languages, and I try to speak both languages. And so, actually, when I was... I had a few friends help me out, you know, throw around ideas with a manuscript. And one of the biggest discussions that we had was whether I should include descriptions or definitions for the Spanglish words or what I should, or the Spanish words, you know. And I didn't really, I just wanted to write it the way that I speak, which is, you know, I got a lot of feedback, a lot of people telling me that I did need to, for the Spanish words and for the Spanish, that I did need to write down definitions, translations, but in the end I decided against it.
Well, I think that's just fine. For me, that's just fine. I think other readers will, I mean, if the work is sufficiently interesting to you, if you really want to enter into it, then you will take the trouble to decode it. I mean, that's what you do with any good poem. It cannot be just simply read on the surface. It has deeper meanings. And it requires, you know, I forget who said it, but, you know, somebody said that in order to have great theater, you need great audiences. Well, in order to have great poetry, you need great readers of poetry. You need people that are willing to make the commitment to go into the poetry and squeeze out every drop of meaning that's in there. And people who, I mean, you know, there's, it's not like this, I don't want to intimidate people by talking about the book in that way. You can appreciate it with a single reading, but you will get much more out of it if you go into it. I mean, all of the poems are very inviting. The surface texture draws you in, though. So, I mean, even if you only read that surface texture, if you just are interested in the narrative of the poem itself, you will get some pleasure from that. But I think you will get much more pleasure, much more appreciation if you go into the poem. When you come across these unfamiliar expressions and phrases, look them up. I mean, research them. It's like... That to me is the value of a good book of poetry. So we've been talking about this. I wondered if you would be willing to read one of your poems. One I was thinking of was Corelia no Esta. So that's perfectly perfect example of what we've been talking about.
Yeah, definitely. Let me look it up real quick. What page is on?
Yeah, that's page 67.
Okay, got it. So this poem I wrote, we have an interview. If you've read the news, the Frontera news, you're aware of how women have gone missing.
Yes, yes.
For the past 20, 30 years. We don't know. There's always questions. Victims are always blamed. You know, they're blamed. Like, why? Why did this happen to her? What did she do?
Mm-hmm.
So yeah. This poem is based on some of the women I know who have gone missing. Pero ya no está. No basta a billion questions asked. ¿Dónde está? ¿Cuándo regresa? When did she disappear? Who's looking for her? ¿Con quién andaba? ¿En qué se involucró? Was she American? Do you think she's dead? ¿Y su familia? It's quickly done to fit the same response. I don't know. All I can tell you with certainty is Karel ya no está. Of all the billion things trying to figure themselves out, that is one thing for sure. In this life of waiting and not knowing, lo que fue, fue.
Yeah, that's a wonderful poem, I think. I really like that poem. And just for our listeners, the valley that Priscilla is talking about is the Rio Grande Valley, not the San Fernando Valley or some other valley. We're,
that is true.
That, yeah, and the frontier
true.
We are talking
about
is
about
not
that.
It's we're not talking about a European frontier or anything. We're talking about the frontier between the United States and Mexico, and of course, the previous administration drew a lot of very, very false information about what was happening on the frontier. A lot of horrible stereotypes, insulting stereotypes, and if you want to disabuse yourself of some of those, I recommend this book for that other reason. And you titled the book La La Landia. What was behind giving it that title?
The music, the la las that go into it, you know, and it's just everything. Music has always been a big inspiration in my family. I think to all of us, music inspires us. It's part of our culture. Music tells stories, and so we played around with titles, and that one just seemed to stand out. La La Landia.
Well,
the music of my land, you know.
Yeah, well, there's, you know, I've said several times before when talking to poets, one of the sort of generally accepted taxonomies of a poem is that there are these three elements working together, the ideas, the images, and the music of the poem. And one of the things that I think we lose when we write in free verse is we tend to lose that music, and we have to figure out a way of bringing that back in without imposing the old meter and rhyme that was so characteristic of earlier poetry. And I think you do that very well. And then speaking of music that we were talking about a moment ago, another poem that addresses that and that I think is exemplary is A Name That Brings Back a Memory, Timbiriche. And let's see, that's on page...
Oh, yeah, on page 52, right before that one. So,
51 I've got, yeah.
Yes, there we go. Yeah, so growing up here in the border, you know, going to Reynosa, which is our on the other side of the frontera, I was always staying with my cousins and, you know, my aunts, and I would go stay the weekend. I would go stay on, like, summer vacations. You know, sometimes you just want to go where you're spoiled. And coming from a big family, that's where I would get spoiled. And so... Timbiriche was a really popular pop group back in the day, and so even now they're still really popular. And so this is a poem that I wrote based on a memory. Name that brings back a memory, Timbiriche. Timbiriche is the name of an 80s Mexican pop group, with the likes of Paulina Rubio, Eric Rubin, and Thalia having been members of it. One of the most popular groups from Mexico, with their music still being a significant influence on mainstream pop culture. They remind me of being a kid, visiting Tia Chuy and Mama Linda and Reynosa, of the Coca-Cola bottles fresh out of the icebox, and dulces I could buy for a peso from the tiendita near Tia's house. more specifically, Timbiriche reminds me of my flower girl days and my primo Pilarin, a teenage noviero with a huge celeb crush on Thalia. Timbiriche reminds me of one particular flower girl dress my mother had to put away, of being 7 years old and taking a cruise down the streets of Reynosa, of being coerced by a handsome primo to sing Si No Es Ahora as a secret novias I could tell nobody about, of the gancitos he bribed me with so I could ask Tia to let him take me to paseo, when all it was really for was to pay a call on a new girlfriend. The quinceañera song reminds me of his silent goodbyes, of the news nobody expected as we prepared for his sister's wedding. Timbiriche reminds me of those days before his mother's forever grief. I picture her sitting in her rocking chair as she prepared last-minute details for her daughter's wedding. I hear her impatience, knowing something was wrong when her son wouldn't come home as the morning hours passed. I wasn't there, but I can hear her shrieks when police told her of her only son's death. Timbiriche reminds me of that morning when instead of a wedding, we dressed for a funeral. And that's a true story. That's something, you know, I was a kid, and it just impacted me. That trauma, you know, seeing my family go through that trauma, it has impacted me to date. And so I tied Timbiriche to that because it reminds me of my cousin.
Yeah, well, it ends on an elegiac note, the poem starts with sort of colorful energy, and then we come to this sad ending. But I think the poem is very skillfully constructed to bring us to that denouement, which is a surprise, and at the same time, because of that, it's very moving, I think. Another poem that also has this wonderful internal music is Loca Carel, and I really like that one. So maybe if you would read that one for us.
I'm sorry, which one was it?
Loca Carel. 47, page 47.
Oh, okay. Loca Carel. So this is about, you know, clubbing. On the other side where, you know, growing up, we had laws here in the U.S. that weren't, they weren't the same on the other side. So that was something we grew up with that generations now don't get to experience that. But this is based on that. I loved Música Internacional. I still do. Loca Carel. Tan, tan, tan. Her heels tripping, ears listening, heads turning, checking her out. And then her hands go up in the air. Drums, manat tunes in this Música Internacional club are the tan-tan-tans of her heartbeats. Loca Fresa, all dressed up in provoking riots intended to distract attention towards her. No hay palabras to compare to her modest slang. As car doors open and club doors close and single sweet lives become a search in her weekend excursion, from a real world to this surreal fantasy. Carel was the queen of La Zona Dorada, hitting the night scene with her pricey pair of black heels, her fragrant perfume lingering as her hair inhaled the cigarette smoke wrapping about her. I imagine feeling her hands warm as she hurried me through the VIP crowd, her destination always being to get to that bottle of vodka. Loca Fresa, as she was when old-school Timbiriche songs hit the airwaves, O sea, baby, toca madera, porque ya está otro que se pone de que te bueno, y nada que ver con tu vida de mosca. O sea, ponte lista, porque se te acaba ese look de huele moles. Loca de remate, as her hair spun and we dazed off into a secret world, a fist pumping, eyes closing to the thuds of international pop pieces, and the unity of our offbeat singing, for mine as she led me to her dance floor throne. Dun, 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 I hear in the distance, and I sometimes imagine it could be her. As of this year past and gone, we're simply a bad dream without her missing whereabouts or without closed borders that have taken many others I've known away into the abyss of Frontera mysteries. Perez danced many times the fever of lost dreams, a little too gone for modesty, but I wonder whether he led her away by hand. It shouldn't matter. Jose, I think he thinks through, doesn't explain when by that time we had many distances separating our identities. I read poems now. When I borrowed songs before, our identity split into two. No quise detenerla when we grew apart, and without a body, and without a trace, there's no reason not to imagine.
Well, it's another really spectacular one for me. Raphael, jump in. But you were saying some interesting things.
To me, I love her poetry. I love the narrative, and I like the way the poetry just tells me the story, like within those lines. And a lot of people don't know how to do it, and then she starts it well and she ends it well, and it reminds me a lot of my history growing up with my Latino family, and I just love reading her work, and it actually, not a lot of work affects me the way culturally like certain writers do, and her definitely affects me when I read it.
Yeah. So that's there's what I like also about your work, Priscilla, is sort of the range of it. It is all of the poems seem really fresh to me, and they were really interesting for me, not in the sense of I don't share a background with you the way Raphael does. But because that I don't, I get an insight into that background. I get an insight into your life, and that is one of the things that I enjoyed about this book. So let me ask another question.
You know, one of the things. Sure.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say one of the things that I appreciate and love about my community is we're a community of immigrants, and so as mm-hmm. immigrants we're always looking to pertain, to belong, we're always looking for family, and so that's one of the things that reading other poets, reading other writers from the valley, it's one of the common themes where we make friends out of our families, we make friends out of our acquaintances, our colleagues. We're always looking to pertain. So I hope this is one of the things that I try to, one of the things that I wanted to include in my book, that narrative of wanting to belong, wanting to pertain, needing that bond, that community, which is important for many of us that are trying to document our regions, whether we're artists, whether we're authors and poets, whether we're musicians. There's so many ways that we try to document the stories that are happening around us and the stories that have happened. So hopefully that's something that I was able to portray in some of these poems.
Well, you succeeded for me, definitely. Definitely.
Me too.
And definitely. Yeah. And there's a rich history in this book too. There are specific events that inspired these poems. There are a couple of footnotes here and there giving some background on that. And so not only is this there's an expression that the poet Anne Waldman uses called poetry as news, and this fits in that category of poetry as news. News in the sense that something is still things that happened before, still resonate. They are still happening. There are repetitions of these things. In other words, there are things that are open-ended. They are not closed. We haven't achieved closure on a lot of topics yet, particularly the question of immigration, the question of borders. One of the things is people. The longer you've lived, the more generations that you've come from that have lived in the U.S., the less you have a connection to that immigrant background. And my parents were born in the U.S., but my grandparents were immigrants. And growing up, I thought that everybody's grandparents, if they are who are really grandparents, speak with an accent or they barely speak English at all. And when I met more regular, what is the saying, WASP friends and met their grandparents who spoke perfect English and behaved differently. And I said, those guys can't be grandparents. You know, that's not how you work. And so, but from a child's perspective, you know, you grow up and you think, well, you know, this is the way it is. Everybody's, you know, my parents were born here, but my grandparents were born in the old country. And one of the experiences for me when visiting those grandparents was stepping back into that old country, because the books were in a different language, the decor was different, the food was different, the old musty odor of their apartment was different. It was all, you know, that was their world that they had managed to recreate in the new world. And you were born, where exactly were you born again?
I was here in South Texas, or I should say deep South Texas. We're about 4 hours south of San Antonio.
Okay.
Here in the Rio Grande Valley.
So you were born in the U.S., but you presumably have lots of relatives in Mexico.
Yes.
And
yes,
do you go back and forth a lot
to
see those relatives?
I used to. You know, when all this insecurity, all this, I call it, I have a poem that talks about a little bit, the invisible borders, you know, with all the inseguridad, like all the insecurities happening on the other side,
mm-hmm.
it kind of, you know, it split us. So a lot of my relatives ended up coming to this side. They ended up, you know, moving into the U.S., immigrating into the U.S., and then the family that we have left behind, I don't know them anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you know, it's been maybe 20 or 15 years where that divide happened.
Yeah. So, sort of shifting gears a little bit, what advice do you have for somebody that is going to, that wants to write poetry, somebody that is inspired to write poetry from reading your work specifically? And I know that there will
the
be
most
people
important
who have
thing,
that.
The most important thing is to find your community. You need your community. You know, it doesn't necessarily have to be other poets or other people taking the same art form as you. Just find your community, like our community here in the Valley. It includes poets, it includes musicians, it includes photographers, journalists, artists of all, you know, all different backgrounds. And you need that. You need it because they keep you informed. They make you reliable. They keep you on track, and they motivate you. And whether you meet once, twice, every few months or so, that community is really helpful, and they understand you, because as a poet, my family doesn't understand what I'm talking about or why I make a fuss out of something or why I'm metiche is what they call me, metiche, like why I want to know everything, and why I'm so curious. And so other artists, other writers, or they'll understand you. They'll understand that need to know more, that need to dig up and document what's going on. So that's the most important thing. Find your community.
Good advice. Very good advice. Looks like we were running out of time for this segment.
Yep.
So we have been talking to Priscilla Selena Suarez about her book, La La Landia, published by Flower Song Press. It's a terrific book. Order it directly from the publisher. They have a website. You can go there and order directly from the publisher or seek it out at your local independent bookstore. And as a last resort only, order it from Amazon. But it's most important to support independent publishers, especially one like Flower Song Press, which is doing such great work in bringing all of these wonderful voices to us. I mean, everything has been that they've published that I've read has been first rate. So once again, Priscilla, thank you for your time. I love the book, and good luck with all of your future endeavors.
Thank you. Thank you so much, and likewise.
Okay, now we have Terry and William Boardman. Howdy.
Hello.
Hello.
How's it
going?
How
are you two? Pretty good.
Good.
So, when did you start running? I mean, when did you guys start running together?
It was like last year, 2 years maybe.
Yeah, I think that the COVID-19 kind of blurs that time period. But
yeah.
It was almost 3 years now.
COVID-19 shrunk me down to like 129 pounds, and that got scary because I wasn't going to the gym anymore. Yeah, no,
right.
I did not like.
I
love the running, but I didn't
went
like the
weight
loss.
Way where it got us.
Hmm?
Got us. I think that COVID actually got us going and more in running. That we had more time at home and.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Wanted to get more outdoors.
How many marathons have you run? How many 5Ks and marathons have you run together?
We haven't run too many 5Ks or marathons. What mainly we've been doing are ultras, so 50Ks.
Wow.
50.
Okay, that's just pushing it a little farther.
We do a little 5Ks when they come up locally, just, you know.
Yeah.
But neither of us are big into road running, so we try to avoid the road.
So, but how, so you've already both adjusted to 50Ks and running the longer runs.
Yeah, we like to do more of the long distance on the trail, so, because the road just, like, gets me bored. I like to go through the forest and see stuff.
I don't disagree. I like trails more too. But I'm in California. Most of the times I got to run on the road. I mean, most of the trail runs here are like half marathons. And I got one coming up that's the Bulldog that's a 50K that's in a trail, but those are rare over here.
Yeah.
No, I'd rather do trails. But how is a 50K on your body? Because you're 13. I mean, you're a younger age. I mean, how do you recover from a long run?
I usually, like, come home and rest, and I also do, like, really small, like, just a lap around the block kind of run to keep my body going, but I don't want to overwork it after it.
You know about the last – go ahead.
William's main sport is swimming, so, you know, that's very low impact, and that helps a lot in the recovery, but it's pretty amazing. The how do you recover question for me at 47 is more pertinent. He'll run a 50K and the next day be sore, and then he'll be done. It'll be like he never ran anything. His recovery time is just non-existent. Pretty amazing.
Funny. No, I mean, I'm 56, and I'll run a marathon. I'll be able to run 5 miles the next day, but I don't know. I haven't done the 50K yet. I mean, I'm doing my first 50K coming up in August. It's an extra six. I mean, everybody keeps telling me it's still an ultra, but I still feel like it's a little baby ultra, you know? It's like, it's not a major ultra. It's not 50 miles yet.
Right. Yeah. No, I agree. I know you run a lot of marathons. Is that what I'm getting?
Yeah, no, I've done about, this year, about six.
Yeah. So, you know, though, that last, say, what, five to eight miles of the marathons, you know how it just turns into a different energy?
Well, oh, yeah.
Once you hit that 26-mile mark and then go, wow, I've got another 5 miles to go from here. It really makes a difference. I think those last 5 miles of a 50K. I don't know, William, what do you think?
It's almost the best but worst miles at the same time, because you're like, I'm about to finish this, but then again, it's like, I still got 5 miles to go.
Right. When we're running, we get close to the ends, like especially in the 50Ks, but we start chopping it down. We're like, all right, we only have a 15K left. We can do that. That's easy. Oh, we only have a 10K left. Just think, it's our nightly run. You know, that's all we have. And then, oh, just a 5K. We can knock this out in like 30 minutes, of, you know. And then before we know it, we're finished. And mental game like it all is, you know. Even a 5K can be a mental game.
I interviewed someone recently who said it's about mindset, too, that your mind, you also got to be, you know, you have to have your mind ready for it, too, because a lot of people, I've seen a lot of people choke like 10, 20 miles because they didn't properly train, they overran, and a bunch of stuff they do themselves when they run.
Sure. Yeah, I think a large percentage of it, wouldn't you agree, William, that is mental. I think a great example of that was the last 50K that we ran together. William was just totally not into it from the get-go.
Yeah.
And he dropped.
Yeah, because I just didn't have a good mindset for it.
Yeah. I felt it, too. And just before the race even started, I could just tell his normal energy wasn't there. But that was, like, close on the heels of the 50-mile you had just done, too. So I think he was a little burnt on it, but... So it was an interesting one. It was a 12-hour.
I could see that. The mindset, because when I do a marathon, I always like, why am I doing this again? But like, once you get into the miles, 2 to 3 miles, you start just. Yeah, I go like straight, like, I guess the endorphins kick in, and the miles just seem to pass. I mean, how does it go for you?
What do you think?
I forgot.
I think it's true to a point, and depends on a lot of variables. Like the miles go past really easy when the temperature, you know, the climate's nice, when the terrain's not too rugged. But some of the ones we've done, one that stands out in particular was in Ohio. It's called the Jackson 50. Yeah, remember that one?
Yeah, there's so many big hills. And there are leaves on it. So when you're going down the hills, you just slide down the hills.
Yeah.
And there's like zero flats. The only flat was like when you started, and that's all.
Right. It was just this knee-high fallen leaves, and you couldn't see what was below you. There was rocks and roots sticking up that you couldn't see. You just kind of had to go and hope you didn't trip. And... Yeah, that was just not the race that, you know, had that example. But, you know, then there's other ones that are, you know, just easygoing trail, nice down, well. And those are the ones that are more, you just kind of tune your brain out. But, yeah, that Jackson one. And also, too, the Jackson was, it was a 10-mile loop. And we had
to do... Loops.
Yeah, 3 loops of it. And the third loop, we were so sick of it. We were like, I don't want to do this. It reminded me of Formula One racing or NASCAR racers, you know. I was like, how can they do 80 laps?
I don't know. I don't get it either because, I mean, the L.A. Marathon used to be okay. I really don't like it, but they took a loop in it. And it's like towards the end, you think you're about to finish and you see the finish line, but you still got to loop around like another 4 miles. And it's like, why?
Yeah. Makes it hard to continue for me too, because when I know that, okay, here we come back to the start line again, I have to go do another 10-mile loop, or I can just call it good, you know.
do you have any favorite races that you like going back to? I mean, have you found one that, like, you know, sticks out that you like running?
What was your favorite one?
I really liked the 50-miler we did.
The Big Turtle?
Yeah, the Big Turtle was one of my favorites. I just loved the way it was set up and how you would do it.
Yeah, so the Big Turtle here in Kentucky was on the Sheltowee Trace, which is a big thru-hike trail that runs from Tennessee all the way to the northern border of Kentucky. And they did an in-and-out and back on that. And I agree, that was fun. It was a fun trail.
So, how do you, 50 miles, you're 13. That's a lot. How do you pace and what do you do for like hydration or nutrition when you're running?
Coke and gummy bears.
Seriously?
Yeah, that's pretty much it.
Yeah. He's been asked that in several interviews he's had, and it's the honest answer. You know, at first he looks at me like,
what is it, Coke and gummy bears?
Things like.
I eat the grapes and stuff at the
aid stations. But
gummy bears, really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Damn.
Yeah, I'm right now I'm just getting ready. I'm trying to figure out how to hydrate for the 50K right now, because I don't hydrate much when I do marathons, but I know
for
the 31 mile run I gotta hydrate, because this one's probably going to be about 8 o'clock, so the heat's going to be up. I know it's going to be a hot run, so
William's progression in maturity has been an interesting thing to watch over the few years here. That was the main obstacle I had in the beginning, was he would never drink anything. And I had to monitor that so closely, because he'd get these terrible, remember on the Knobstone Trail, we did a 50 miler on the Knobstone Trail in Indiana, and he didn't drink, and all of a sudden his stomach, just knotted up. So it was constantly me watching his, hydration intake. And then we got to the Big Turtle 50 miler here in Kentucky. And because I'm so cautious about his intake, it drives him crazy now, because now he's gotten to a maturity as a runner to handle it himself. But I'm still dad, and I'm
always be dad.
Like, leave me alone and try to keep up.
So, what do you guys, do you guys stay together during the 50 mile run, or does one pass another one and wait for the other one to finish?
The answer to that is different now than it would have been not too long ago. It used to be that he would stay with me and just kind of pace with me, and I'd watch his pace, but he is now way faster than I am, and I cannot keep up with him. So I've had to bring in some friends of mine that are better runners than me to be able to stay with him, which he then has now exceeded their abilities, and they can't keep up with him. So the only one I have left is Jason Wish, who is, he holds the FKT record for several trails out there in the United States. And that's the only friend I have left that can actually stay with William and keep up with him.
Wow. What are your PR times for the 50K, for the 50 miles?
What did you do for the 50 mile?
I think it was
13. Yeah. We don't really have a good time on him, because for the 50 miler, he came in around about 13 hours, which isn't a very good time. But a lot of that was him pacing with me for the first 20 miles. And then he sat on the side of the trail with my faster friend who had stomach problems for 30 minutes waiting for him to feel better until he finally took off on his own and finished the race by himself.
Wow.
So we don't have a good PR time, his PR times, because he's held back, basically. I think.
Oh, yeah, to me, you accomplished 50 miles. So, the PR time really doesn't mean much. It's an accomplishment just to win the 50 miles,
Yeah, those times will come in when he starts feeling comfortable to go his own and run his own race without someone with him. I'm comfortable at certain events, certain venues for him to do that. The Jackson 50 would be one of them, because it's a 10-mile loop. There's a lot of traffic on it of people being lapped, so that you're constantly around people. I wouldn't be comfortable with him doing the big turtle that we just did, because that pack spreads out so far. There's nobody around for miles. Just not yet, you know.
Well, no, I mean, I appreciate what you're saying, because, I mean, you know what happened in the news recently with, I think it was a six-year-old who ran a marathon with his family, and everybody got upset about it. So you're taking precautions, because I don't know about that family, because, come on, they gave him Pringles for running a marathon. I mean, come on, you got to give the kid a little bit more for making the kid run a marathon than just Pringles. I just don't know.
Out of the fact. I am familiar with it because through some of the interviews we've done with William, especially when he was 12, we got some flack from, you know, just sort of online nonsense type of stuff.
Yeah.
You know, where we had a lot of hate slinging around, you know, he's too young to be doing this, and, you know,
The flack's wrong, because, I mean, from what you're telling me, you're actually taking care of him. You're running with him. You're watching his hydration. You're paying attention. I mean, that's the most important. That's the key thing, that you're actually, you know, you're paying attention. I mean, some people don't even pay attention. So, I mean, I think you're doing right by him, because, I mean, you're still waiting for him to let him go. You're not ready to let him do it by himself yet. So that's cautious.
A couple of things that I think have come out of that light, and it is a pretty, you know, pertinent topic right now with that particular family. And I'm not judging on that. I don't know all the facts surrounding it, but the major one is that he can quit doing this anytime he wants. I'm not dragging him to these events. I'm not a runner, you know, I'm doing this because he wants to do this. So, you know, there's that side of it. And then the other one that I get too is that, you know, him doing this, he's going to burn out. And, you know, that's probably one of the most confusing complaints I get is, you know, that this is too much for him. You're going to burn him out. Well, if he burns out, I think that's a weird way to describe what he's doing. Because for me, it would be he tried something. He did it until he didn't want to do it anymore. And now he's going to go do something else. If you want to label that as burn, end, you know, but.
I mean, that's kind of silly because from hearing him talk about it, he enjoys it. He's doing it. And, you know, and I mean, people should be happy that your son's actually doing something constructive, because, I mean, when I was 13, I wasn't doing anything like that. I was rebelling. I was drinking. I was pretty bad at that age. So, you know.
Yeah,
I mean, people have to look at the positive side that, you know, he's doing something that's keeping his health up. I mean, I think it'd be different if you had a kid who was like 10, 12, lifting weights, which, you know, was too early for the body. I don't think running is that the same thing, you know. I don't think...
Mm-hmm.
I mean, as long as you're paying attention and taking care of him, making sure he's doing all right by it, and you got people running with him, then, you know, you're being a good dad. I mean, most people are going to comment no matter what happens, good or bad. So they're always going to have an opinion, even if you don't want it. I mean, that's just human nature. People are going to voice their opinion, even if you're not asking for it. Even if they don't understand running, even if they never ran a race, they're going to give their opinion. And, you know, you can either pay attention to it or just ignore it. You know, most days, I mean, most things I think you should just ignore as long as William's happy and you're happy supporting him. That's all that should matter.
Right.
Yeah. So do you guys eat certain things you train, or is it just like, you know, eat whatever you can? Because, I mean, I'm at that point these days. Eat whatever I can and hope it doesn't mess up my running.
I think we got two different answers. You know, for him and me, for him, it just doesn't matter. You know, he can eat whatever he wants. He's got a huge metabolism, and he does naturally just eat healthy. He's certainly not the kid that I have to constantly, you know, quit eating this. We're not a big snack family either, so there's not like ho-hos and Twinkies in the cupboard all the time and anything like that. So that option's not really there. But I mean, I think given what would, you know, what kind of food do you want to get into? It's peanut butter, you know, that's probably his number one food he eats, but he works out so much that it doesn't really matter what he eats, you know.
Well, you mentioned peanut butter. I've been eating peanut butter for lunch for the last 3 years. Peanut butter sandwiches. No, because it's affordable. I mean, I eat more for dinner, but peanut butter's got protein and it's affordable. And for some odd goddamn reason, I don't understand. I'm not sick of it yet. You know?
Yeah.
I just got used to it, you know.
But no, I don't think, you know, for him, it's not really an issue of eating. No, for me, you know, at 47, it is constantly a struggle for me. You know, I'm always trying to do what I can to, you know, not put weight on, especially when I'm injured or we're in our off season right now. We don't like running in the heat, so we don't do these ultras in the heat of summer here in Kentucky. It's just deadly hot. We put our shoes away and we hit the pool. So we swim all through the summer and then come fall we'll pick it back up again.
That sounds like a good plan. I mean, for me, my first 50K is probably going to be in the heat. So I'm like, kind of like, was that a good time to plan it? I'm not sure yet.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, heat is a big factor. People don't not understand how heat is a factor when you run.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, because there's people who run Death Valley and that, to me, is a lot. And there's people who run in Arizona in the heat, which is kind of crazy to me.
Yeah, sure. I try to acclimate to it. I just don't enjoy the acclimation process enough to want to do it. And again, I'm not a serious enough runner to put myself through an acclimation. I went down to Texas and tried to acclimate to the heat down there for 2 weeks. And I ended up just giving it up and having a good hike. I was like, this is just not, I'm not interested in this. This is too much work. I'm not trying to win medals. I'm trying to have fun. And that wasn't fun. So,
how many races have you done, has William done, and you've done all together since he started? And they've all been
five.
Most of them
official.
Most of them been 50 miles, and I mean for 50K and 50 miles.
Most of them have been 50K, and then we did two: the Turtle and the Knobstone.
Mm-hmm.
They were two 50-milers.
So you haven't gone down to a 26 miles. You just went straight for the 31 miles.
Right.
Wow.
Yeah.
Most people I've talked to, 5K, then a half marathon, then a marathon, then to get to the ultras. I mean, you skip that whole thing right there.
Yeah. Well, that kind of the background to that is that, like I said earlier, I'm not really a runner. I really am a hiker, but I've been hiking these really long distances, interested in trying to tackle some FKTs, unsupported type stuff. And I realized to be able to, you know, get some of these fastest known times in these trails, there's no way to do it hiking. You've got to run.
Yeah.
So I said, you know, I can run. So I started doing that, and then he took to it, and then it evolved and landed into this. So.
No, I mean, it sounds great that you two are able to do that, and you have something you both share, and it's just, I mean, my son's 10 right now, and he's away from me, but he likes the fact that I run, and he eventually wants to run with me. But it's you've already got it going, which is great. I mean, you know, I mean, there's not many instances where you actually have something you can really share with your kid, you know, and that to me is really great.
Yeah.
You know. Yeah, and the whole thing and you're very careful too. You're very cautious. You make sure he hydrates, even though he doesn't, you know, makes him probably nuts. you know.
Yeah, I think now it does. Leave me alone.
Well, no, I mean, everybody gets to that point, you know. I mean, I have a hard time getting training tips, but if someone gives me a good training tip, I actually listen. But sometimes I just get very stuck in, like, I know what I'm doing, you know.
Right.
You know, right. And being pigheaded isn't always a good thing, you know, when you're, when someone's giving you better advice and you're not listening.
It's actually a really great feeling when you get told off by your kid. And then you realize that he's graduated, you know, and that was a moment, and that happened at the 50 miler at one of the aid stations. And, you know, I was rattling off and sounded like his mother, you know, William, make sure you drink as much as you can and then fill your bottles. And he just, you know, was just not paying attention to me. He was trying to get in and out of that aid station as fast as he could. And I just kind of stood there and watched him operate. And he, you know, he went to the electrolyte, filled his electrolyte bottle up, chugged that while he filled his water bottle up, refilled his electrolyte bottle, snapped it into his vest, and just was off. And I just kind of stood there and watched it all happen. And it's kind of one of those moments in my life, like when my kids were born, that you just burns into you, and you'll take with you forever. And, you know, everything happened in slow motion, and almost every detail is burned into my memory because it was just a real pivotal moment in my life with him and running and my life in general to see him graduate and mature to that level of, I got this now. I don't need you. It's a good thing.
No, it's a good feeling. How does his mom feel about the running?
Go ahead, William. You can talk a little bit.
I mean, she loves that I do it, but she's also very, like, cautious of it, too. Like, she goes, like, sure, he should be running this far at this age. She makes sure that
sounds like a mom.
My after me constantly.
Mm.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, and that's let off a lot now, too. In the last year, William has sprouted like 8 inches tall and just turned into a muscle. And it's a little different now. I don't think she has any concerns about him now. But when he was 12, he was pre-puberty still. And he looked like a little kid, man. You know, when he was on that starting line, there wasn't a head that wasn't turned looking at him going, who's that kid? You know, now he's as tall as some of the shorter men. So he kind of fits in and until you really look at him and realize his features say this kid's young.
Yep.
You almost don't even know that he's 13. He looks maybe 15 or so. But it was when he was 12, there was a lot. But again, you know, I had a small rope tied to him, metaphorically, you know.
Yep.
You know, William, even then he was beating me up some of the hills. And, you know, William, you wait every top of every hill for me. Don't go down the next side, you know, that kind of thing. So.
Yeah, that makes sense. So when right now you're just taking it easy till it cools down.
Yeah, that's we're not into the heat. No heat running for us. Plus, we swim. He's a very competitive swimmer. He's a state champion here in Kentucky. And, you know, he just entered Division I swimming. So, you know, that's a big part of his life and our life, too.
Well,
so,
he's still active, even though he's not running, which is great. So it doesn't, you know, you don't get lazy.
Right. Know? Right. Yeah. He just signed up for cross country. That's his latest thing, so see how that goes. It'd be well.
So
a little short.
You're not good. So basically we're talking maybe gearing up again in September or November or like later?
Probably end of September, October is when the temperatures around here get to be reasonable.
A little cooler.
Yeah.
We're getting closer in the show, but we're getting close to the end of the show, but I'd love to have you both come back on, like, you know, when when you've ran more races, maybe in 6 months. Because, I mean, the whole thing with me about the show is I'm very into the running community, so I like to bring people back and, you know, perhaps talk about, like, where they progress or where they're going, you know.
Right.
And maybe actually, maybe next time, you know, he'll already surpass you, and he just me and William talking, or just, you know, who knows, because you're telling me he's, like, you know, gotten to the point where he outdistances you now, and he's running farther than you.
Oh, yeah. By far.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Nah, I think that'd be, I mean, go on, sorry.
I just said thanks for having us on the show.
No, it was great because, you know what, actually you guys inspired me because your kid's 13. He's running 50 miles, and I'm nervous about a 31-mile run, you know.
Yeah, you'll be fine.
I love having guests that actually, you know, give me, you know, like help me further my own thing, and then I like hearing their stories because it just shows me that, you know, you both have a mindset, you know. You're watching out for him, but his mindset is just like, you know, already, you know, getting there and getting it done, you know, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks a lot for being on the show. I definitely want to have you back on maybe in 6 months.
Cool. Appreciate you.
Yeah. This has been the Poet Runner podcast, and we just had Terry and William Broadstone, and it was actually pretty interesting hearing about someone who's a lot younger than me running more miles than me. But yeah, it was a great having you two on. Thanks a lot. And that's been the Poet Runner podcast.
Take care.